This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com. All right. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the pod staff. With me today, I have Mr. Tom Pache. So Tom is a corporate entertainer and keynote speaker who fuses world-class magic with transformative motivational strategies. By teaching teams and executives how to reframe their perspectives and build deeper connections, he helps global organizations foster bulletproof workplace cultures and unlock peak performance. So Tom, thank you so much for being on today. Hopefully that intro described you well, but share a little bit about yourself.
Wow, Michael, I hope I can live up to that, man. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on here. And yes, that is what I do. And it seems like, you know, a year and a half ago, if you told me that was what I'd be doing full time, I probably wouldn't believe you because my background is in education. I spent 20 years teaching fourth grade and sixth grade public school, Westchester, New York. Absolutely loved it. And it taught me so much about leadership. At the same time, you know, I had always developed younger teachers and got my administrative degree and always gave keynotes and had also been pursuing a career in magic since I was 12 years old. So it was, while on the one hand, there are these two different lives I was leading, it really was the synergy between the two, the marriage of both that brought me to where I am. And after 20 years of teaching, it was time not to leave the classroom because I absolutely love teaching. That is who I am. It is still what I do. It was really to make the classroom bigger. And so now as a full-time speaker, magician, MC, and an entrepreneur, it's what I get to do working with teams, both corporate and educational, all across the country and the world, really, which is an absolute gift. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I wanted to touch first on the teaching aspect because I've interviewed a handful of keynote speakers and entertainers and stuff like that, and you're the first one that's came from school teaching to doing just like full-time entrepreneurship, keynote speaking and entertaining and magic and stuff like that. And I just think that it's so fascinating just on through our conversation before about how you, your love for teaching started with teaching kids. And it's also now to where you're kind of fully pivoted to where you're speaking to corporate leaders and with these massive companies and stuff like that. So I want to hear a little bit about the teaching.
Oh, well, for so long, it was hard for me to really feel like, you know, I was worthy in one space and you know, coming from the other, you know, I always felt like I knew how to teach. I was a great teacher and I loved it. But, you know, being in front of a Fortune 500 company, for them to know I was going back to a fourth grade classroom, sitting on the carpet, reading a book, like it almost at that point felt like, how do these two worlds coexist? And what I learned was, they actually are so similar in so many ways. And one of them being that, you know, the same ingredients that go into a great classroom, which is total engagement, right? Ownership over what's being taught. The students feel like they own their learning and really a sense of love. That's the biggest part of any culture is love. And we define that in the classroom as sacrifice, which is, what are you willing to give up for somebody else? What are you willing to give up for something you don't have? And when you do those things and you do it with a true heart, because it is a calling, it creates this environment, not for students to remember every single thing that you taught them, but for them to want to return and want to stay in the space that you created with them, not just for them, but with them. And that's the same thing we see in corporate America. People want so badly to feel that trust and respect to stay in an organization that really values who they are and that they feel they can have a stake and they can be a part of. So many times we hear about buy-in, you know, but it's really investing in. Are we investing in our people, and do people feel like they own a piece of what they're doing, who they're working for? When they feel that, they want to be a part of it. So teaching has always been in my blood. Both my parents are teachers. My mom is still a teacher. She teaches music in nursery school. My dad was a educator and principal of an elementary school for over 40 years. And when I was a little kid, going into his school, it was basically the opposite of my school. You know, like my school was desks and rows. I don't know what it was like for you, but it wasn't the most creative environment all the time. And my dad had music in the hallway. He had, you know, things popping out of the ceiling, and that, like, just all of this, like, he truly fashioned it after Walt Disney, and just saying, like, what if we could do something that doesn't normally happen? And we just made that a regular thing. Like, that became our culture. And so, of course, like, that changes people's lives. And I was like, yeah, I could do this. So that was a big piece of me wanting to become a teacher. It was also seeing role models like my dad, like my cousin Carl, who taught fifth grade in my dad's school, somebody who married one of my cousins, Tracy. His name is Rob Castagna. He was the gym teacher in that school. And so seeing males in elementary education, I don't think we always associate that. And for me to realize, like, yeah, this was cool. This was something I could do. And I can also have a life that I love, support my family. And, you know, I tell my students, if you can solve problems while helping people and having fun, like, you have a great job. And so that was just in me. And it was also a job, not to belabor the point, but, like, it was a job where I felt like it wasn't just one thing. Like, I could exercise all of my passions and talents in teaching with my students, from music to magic to film to, like, all of these acting, like, all of these components. And I really just saw a lesson, like a great magic routine. Whereas, like, I start with the demonstration, we then do this together. And I want to leave you with this feeling, like, the ultimate lesson should be that it's something that your students can do on their own without you. That's a great teacher, right? It's leaving them in a way that they can take care of themselves without you. And so that's how I want magic to be as well. It's something that, you know, I show you, but we then participate in together, and then you take with you. And so, yeah, great lessons for me. Just like a plot map, it has those twists and turns, the problems you solve. But it was something that I always loved, and I still feel like everything I approach, from my keynote to my show, it still has the element of teaching. Because if you can teach somebody something well, I feel like you really have the components of any great keynote or show.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm almost jealous hearing you talk about, like, your teaching strategies and stuff, you know, back to my childhood, because I'm like, yes, I did have some good teachers, but really, just, I can probably count on one hand or less the amount of, like, teachers that really stuck with me. And I had a lot of teachers too, and I think a lot of people could say this, that they were not really happy with their lives. Like, and it wasn't probably because of teaching; it was just something they brought to the classroom from outside. And I think too, as children, we think that a lot of times we just kind of assume that children are just in their own little world. They're not really noticing anything. But I mean, children notice a lot of stuff that we wouldn't think that they do. And they also pick up on positive things. And a teacher like what you just described and your methods and stuff like that, I'm sure that it's touched many, many students' lives. And I can definitely see how you might be one of those teachers that you're, you know, 20 years later saying, man, Tom was the best teacher I ever had. He really changed my life. You know, because it's rare to be one of those people, but those people touch so many lives.
Well, thanks for saying that, Michael. And it's funny, you're not alone in the bad teacher category. I will be honest with you. I had, you know, a very small handful of great teachers, luckily, in my family as well. But it was also because of the terrible teachers I had that made me keep saying, I wouldn't do it that way. You know, I want it. What you're doing, and, like, I literally got kicked out of one class my entire life. It was in high school. I won't say who the teacher was. But I remember saying, like, this is not how you do it. Like, this is not how you teach, and this isn't how it should be. And I think that really made me want, like, if you feel there's a gap in the market somewhere, right, and you could do it differently that hasn't been done before, like, that's even more the reason to do it. And so that became a calling for me to be like, I think I could change this. And then ironically, when you said maybe 20 years later, people will be talking about you, like, don't underestimate what children are absorbing. So much more is caught than taught. And I do now see the proof of that. Like this coming weekend, I am going to a wedding of two of my students that were in my, this is crazy, in my fourth grade class. They were 9 years old, Chris and Alyssa. They are now 30 years old. Okay. And they are getting married this Saturday. I'm going to be at their wedding. And when they, you know, tell you like, Mr. Pache, we now see like what you were doing, you know, the method to the madness. We wrote these songs about our learning and then filmed a documentary about it. And then you taught us the instruments and we performed and parents came in and we published a book and we had like, they see that and they see that you could have just taught them the lesson and given them a quiz, but they were really participating in their education and all the modalities and all the multiple intelligences that, you know, that make it exciting. Because I wanted to, and now they're applying that in their own lives and crazy that they're getting married. So you never know where that ripple ends.
Yeah. It's funny how it's kind of like parenting too. Like there's a lot of things where me and my dad or, you know, someone that really kind of, helped raise me, you know, it could have been a parent, it could have been some other mentors or something like that, but just dad's a good example to say, we butted heads at times, but I can now look back and give him so much grace. And he's like, wow, thank you for appreciating that now, because I'm seeing things and methods and things that he held his ground on that I'm like, man, you are actually just doing me a solid, where a lot of people would have just caved and been like, you know, I'd rather not have the conflict. And I think I've seen that a lot in like teachers and coaches and stuff like that too, where, people are so afraid to be the bad guy for a moment to give someone a gift of potentially a lifetime that they just kind of cave and say, you know, I'd rather be the liked person or the cool person or whatever. And from what you've described, it sounds like you found a way to get both.
Yeah. I don't know if I do it right, but you described it perfectly. I think parenting is exactly that. It's at times how to be the bad guy in order to give the gift. And it's not the immediate gratification. It's the long-lasting, delayed gratification of a gift that is unwrapped slowly and appreciated in the long term for what it is. And when you look back, you realize there are no shortcuts. And I think we see that all too often. And that's how people are approaching their craft, whether it's speaking, business, teaching, or parenting itself. And they don't want to suffer through those moments that might, you might be like this with your student, with your customer, with your client, or with your own child. But, you know, our oldest daughter is now 18. She's going to college. She has an incredible just moral compass, foundation, faith, and who she, and identity in who she is. And that really came through, you know, those really tough times in middle school where it was like, no, you can't have a phone. No, you can't have social media. And here's why. And I think that's the important part. It's like, you have to have that reason, that why, and that methodology that you're convicted of and that eventually your child will understand. If it's just rules and no, then yeah, that rebellion is going to happen and they're going to pull away. But when they can then see it, she now thanks us for not having given her the social media or the phone when she didn't need it. And she's that much stronger. So it's about building that foundation, you know, building that boat. So people say, often will say, but isn't that creating this bubble, like this world that isn't real? They have to, you know, that is the world. They have to be, no, they're not ready yet. You know, I heard once that every alcoholic became an alcoholic because they were introduced to alcohol in their teenage or even younger years. Mm-hmm. And if you can stay away from it into your 20s, then when you encounter it, it's like, yeah, no big deal. Like I'm already beyond it. You know, I'm already strong enough to, but if you're encountering something that you're not yet equipped to handle, it's not going to end well. And we see that far too often. We're giving kids, you know, throwing them into battles they're not yet ready to fight without giving them the armor and the training. It's like Mr. Miyagi, you know, those lessons weren't easy for Karate Kid. Now I'm dating myself, for Daniel to learn, but once he learned them, man, he could take on anybody.
Yeah. And I think you made a key point there of you explain why, because there's a lot of parents and teachers and coaches and people who think that, they actually probably are doing something good in concept, but their delivery is off, or they don't give the reason behind it. And I just had a recent episode with Mark Mears, not released yet, but he and I talked a lot about how the younger generation, especially, is they're not only saying yes, sir, they're saying yes, sir. Why though? And I think that was a really good point because I feel like back in the day, you know, whenever my dad's a boomer, my parents are boomers, and they always told me that it was just like, hey, my parents said this, so I have to do it. No questions asked. And I don't know what changed. I guess just the world is evolving and there's social media and there's more information out there and stuff like that. But younger generations are asking why. And I think if the leaders that we have in our lives can explain why, even if there's a harsh truth, then it just makes everything make so much more sense.
100%. You know, when you know your why, you're able to move closer towards your what with purpose. And that is what young people, I feel, are missing, is what is my purpose? You know, at the end of it all, like, where can I find fulfillment? And it's fulfillment greater than success that is going to give us that long-lasting joy, that happiness. And I think through the more you study this, now that I'm a, you know, full-time speaker and speaking to companies about, you know, these key points, it's you do the research. And the research shows that lasting joy is not something that we can really go after and say, okay, I decide to have or want joy. Joy is a byproduct of the service that we give to others. Joy is a byproduct of the work that we do when it's meaningful. Joy is really the byproduct of a life given with purpose. And when I say purpose, like, I want to do something passionate, right? That I'm passionate about. I want to do something that makes an impact. Well, passion at its core, what does it mean? It means that which is worth suffering for. And so when you can deal with the suffering, and you would do it anyway because you know your why, it again leads you in on that path of pursuing true purpose, and the byproduct is joy. And so those are the ingredients, but you can't get it the other way around. Otherwise, you're going to constantly chase your tail. And I think that unfortunately, you know, long-term delayed gratification and pain is difficult, but it's sometimes why the older we get, we look back and can realize, okay, this was for a purpose, and this is why I'm exactly where I'm meant to be. And I can't say that my life or my career has taken a direct route, and I don't think it was supposed to, but now looking back, I kind of realize all of those moments, even the difficult ones, were all for the right reason.
Have you ever met someone who just hasn't really suffered much in life?
I have, but there's not much to the story when you meet that person. I haven't met anybody who has done anything great who has not suffered. And sometimes, you know, on that token, Michael, I would say that, you know, we almost have to be careful in how we phrase that, because there are times when I've said, maybe I haven't suffered enough. You know, I never got hit by a car. I never lost my limbs. I didn't try to climb Mount Everest and fail. Like, all these big stories that you think you need to have, but it's like, no. It's just, on a daily basis, are you willing to accept your shortcomings? Are you willing to look at your life and not compare, but, you know, take the lessons as hard or, you know, whatever that they may be, and say, this is a learning opportunity? It doesn't always have to be in a huge, grandioso way, but just realizing every day is an opportunity. And I'm honestly grateful for the setbacks, because I never learn without failing. And that failing allows me another concept that's really growth mindset, to then say, okay, how do I recalibrate and grow from it? If you give up through that failing, then you're not moving anywhere. But yeah, I haven't noticed anybody who's really broken through barriers and done anything great without failing and without setbacks and without some suffering.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. And it just seems like, it almost seems like on the surface, wow, that must be a nice life. But it's like, I feel like every couple of years, something happens in my life, or there's a turning point, or there's a decision I have to make, or, you know, whatever. And this started when I was, you know, 21, I would say. And so, sometimes it's big things where it's like, wow, I'm really going through something. And on the surface, it sounds like, wow, if I didn't have that, then that would be, you know, it might be a more calm, regular life. But if I hadn't had all that, honestly, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I wouldn't at all. And I just think it's like, what's your advice to people who are just like almost scared of the suffering, scared of the discipline it takes to suffer and pursue passion and stuff like that. Because I feel like a lot of people shy away from it because it is hard. But every single time I've suffered or anyone I know has suffered, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be in 2 years, it may not be in 10 years, but at some point in life, you say, wow, I'm really grateful for that.
Oh, man, 1,000%. I don't think you can do it until you go through it. And so I would just say embrace that. You know, comfort is a trap. And that is why so many people are just okay with the status quo. They're okay with settling. You know, this many people who listen to your podcast and who are on your podcast are entrepreneurs or have an entrepreneurial spirit. And that is not for everybody. But a big piece of that is taking a risk and betting on yourself and knowing that, you know, so many people look at my life now and they're like, oh, you're going to all these great places and you get to be on stages and speak and perform and it looks great. But what they don't understand is that that is such a risk. There are so many difficult moments. I am in the middle of my life at 44, almost 45 years old with 3 children and a wife depending on me. Like, it sounds and looks fun. It's not fun when you don't know where your next job or paycheck, you know, are going to come from. And having a job with a steady paycheck and benefits, that was easy. And it was a great job and I loved it, but I am always looking for growth. And I've never experienced growth without suffering. And if I'm not growing, I feel like I'm shrinking, I'm dying. And so I used to say this to my co-teacher in the classroom. I was like, Jen, what's next? Like, what are we doing? We've accomplished this. This is great. Is it administration? Is it, you know, I'm looking for that next challenge because I know as difficult as it may be, it's going to lead me to another level of knowing who I am, why I was put on this earth, and again, greater fulfillment. And so I just want to get to the end of my life knowing like there was no gas in the tank. Did I do everything I was supposed to do that God gave me the gifts to explore and to just be that fullest version of myself, as cliche as it sounds? And it might hurt and I might fail along the way, but I'm like, that, let's go. Like, that's, otherwise you're just repeating the same thing. I don't want to stay in the same place. So yeah, embrace the suffering if you want to grow.
Did you ever feel like early on, like you always had the stirring in you to want to just go do your thing and be an entrepreneur? And if so, like, do you feel like looking back, you wish you would have done it sooner, or do you think everything was timed perfectly?
Well, I don't think it's timed perfectly. There is no perfect timing. In a way, I wish I had done all of this when I could take massive risks in my 20s. And so I would say, if you're listening in your 20s, like, go and take those risks. But at the same time, I was always listening to not just what I wanted to do, but like, what is the calling? Like, what is my vocation? Where are my talents best used for others? And it really was teaching. Like, the way that I'm able to speak and perform and the corporate stages that I'm on, I didn't have access to that at 20 years old. And I didn't have the flight time. I didn't have the wherewithal or the expertise to really affect that world at that point, right? So where did I go and get all of that experience and that timing and that, you know, just ability to do what I do? I got it in the classroom. And so it's just constantly asking yourself the question, like, where can I best serve? And I think when you answer that and you just go there, you won't be let down, because you're either going to meet with success and find it, which will then go to lead to fulfillment, or you're going to realize I'm in the wrong place. Okay, let me just be not afraid to change, go to the next thing where I think I can better serve. So it's that old adage, like, let me do the best I can with what I have, where I am, for whoever, you know, I can best serve. And that's what I did. And it was apparent. At the time, I was ready to make that change just a little under 2 years ago. And it wasn't like I'm just going to quit the day job and move on. Like, I had built up this other side of the business where there was enough of a bridge where I felt like it's going to be a risk, but I could make that leap. And it was just at the right time in my life where I could do it.
Yeah. Do you think that whenever you were in your 20s or maybe early 30s, and didn't have all the experience that you have now, and like you said, you have that experience to be able to share with people and coach companies and things like that. Do you think, is it more maybe nerves that you had at that age, or is it really truly you feel like it was knowledge that you did not yet possess to help people?
I think it's experience. People want to know your track record, and they want to realize, like, what is your body of work that you're able to look back on that's tried and tested. You know, this is going to be an experiment that, you know, I actually have data on from having been in this field. So if you're you know, if you're teaching anybody anything, you should have expertise in that area. Now, when I was teaching elementary school, you hit the nail on the head earlier in this conversation when you said it should also be the, like, projecting the life that you want to live. I wasn't showing my students just how to you know, write an essay or how to do something in math. Like, I wanted them to know this is actually how you create a life that you want to live. So if I came in the morning and there was traffic, I told them about it. Like, here's how I reacted to it. I might not tell them about every particular instance or argument at home, but, you know, something's going on at home. They knew about my family. They knew about my kids. They knew about the struggles. And they're absorbing it and they're watching how I deal with that. So I think that's a big piece of it. It's like, okay, here's what I know so far at 20. Now, here's what I know at 30. And there's no right time. You know, somebody's an expert at 19. I'd say, look, you know more than you think you do. That's number one. I wouldn't say you have to wait to do anything. But for me personally, in the work that I do, it was also taking this kind of model of knowing I became the best teacher possible after 20 years in the classroom. And I think this can apply to your company, your organization, or your life in a way that's real. And here's how. And so for me, that was kind of my testing ground, but it can be at any point in your life, depending on what you want to do.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about imposter syndrome to kind of spin off of that, because I think that's something that, whether we admit it or not, like, we all struggle with, especially during any transition. And, you know, your example to those kids, I feel like there had to have been some sort of that going on, to where it's like, all right, these kids think I'm awesome. I'm doing everything I can in the classroom. I'm also doing this, and I'm actually thinking about doing this full time. And you were talking about that balance of going from corporate stages to sitting, reading books to elementary schoolers, you know?
Yeah. I think the imposter syndrome is always going to be there if you are not who you say you are. And once you own, you know, your identity and understand, I'm not trying to be something I'm not. You hear often, like, fake it till you make it. Well, you have to have confidence, and you have to kind of project, where do I want to be, right? There's a magician named Jeff McBride who said, always dress, you know, as if you're going someplace better later, right? Like, dress for the job that you want. It's that same concept. But also understanding and having the vulnerability to realize I don't know everything, and I'm not trying to be a thought leader in an area that I'm not an expert in. I'm just being real. I'm being me. You don't have to be perfect. You have to be real. And people learn more through your shortcomings because they see themselves in you, right? Like, every story that we tell on stage, if you won a gold medal, if you did whatever you did, they're going to learn more from the failings, and they're going to learn more when they see themselves in your story. But yeah, like, I relate to that person. They're just like me. I would tell my students, like, you could write a children's book right now, because most of these authors at 40, 50, 60 years old, they're trying to remember what it was like to be a 10-year-old writing this book from the viewpoint of a 10-year-old. But guess who has the best understanding of what it's actually like to be 10? You. And so when, you know, when we embrace who we are and realize I maybe can't teach every CEO of every company something as if, you know, I know more than they do, but I know that I am best equipped to help the person that I once was. And so when I go in to talk to an education conference, I'm looking at that 26-year-old teacher. I know exactly what they're going through. I'm looking at that person who maybe had their first or second kid, wondering what's next and how they're going to make ends meet. I know how to speak to them. I'm looking at that healthcare worker or that company employee who's saying, I went into this with all the right reasons and all the excitement, and now I feel burnt out, unsupported, let down, underfunded. You know, how do I get to the next step? And that's who I'm best able to help now at this point in my life. And I think if we can ask that question wherever we are in the journey and in whatever you're doing, to just say, you know, who was I last year? Who was I yesterday? Can I help that person? Then you find that client, you find that person. And then the rest is just, don't compare to everybody else out there on social media, because you know what? What you do is not all that unique, but your life is the difference. Your experience in the way that you've done it is what's different. Otherwise, you're going to compare to everybody else who's better than you, more ahead of you, further ahead down the line, and that's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I also feel like, to carry everything that you just said onto a stage, you really do have to do it well. You have to know who you are, because there's times in my life when I've felt super comfortable going and teaching something or speaking at something or giving a pitch or just whatever, because I'm sure of who I am in that that time frame, and I'm sure of the topic that I'm talking about. There are other times, and it fluctuates all the time, where I would shy away potentially from something like that because I'm not feeling sure of who I am. And I feel like there are a lot of people who are not as effective that get on a stage, and it's one of those zone out speeches. From what I've seen, I've watched a lot of clips of your videos. I don't even know if it's possible for someone to zone out at one of your events. And do you think that that's truly because you know who you are and you know who you're trying to reach and you know what you're trying to provide for those people?
I do. And that's a really insightful kind of commentary on your end, because people will often say, well, you're a magician, right? And you've got this stage expertise and you've got this thing that we don't have. And that's actually the furthest thing from the truth, because the point of my keynote is to teach you how to bring the magic and this recipe of intention, surprise, and connection into whatever you do within the hospitality world, within the financial world. And it's these ingredients to just embrace who you are. Like, I knew with all of who I am, even the magic, like, I wasn't for everybody. My very first job, I wanted to teach in this district where I thought this was the best paying, this was where I was meant to be, this was amazing. And for whatever reason, like, all of those great things I brought to the classroom that other people noticed, the students, my co-teachers, the parents, they all loved it. You know who didn't love it? The principal. Like, he almost saw it as a threat. Like, he was very controlling. He wanted it his way. And he was waiting, instead of seeing all the things that I was doing right to build me up, he looked for the one Achilles heel to, like, get me on and bring me down. And it was in an observation lesson when he saw I misspelled a word. I was writing on sentence strips, misspelled this word. And he asked me in the post-observation, like, did you know you misspelled this word? And I didn't. I was like, no, I was just, you know, in the moment, I didn't realize it. And he goes, do you have a spelling deficiency? And I was like, no, you know, I just misspelled a word. He's like, well, I really think this is an important, you know, thing. It can't be an oversight. And there's not going to be a position next year for you here. You should probably keep putting the resume out there. And, you know, it then made me see, I was like, should I even be teaching? You know, it rattled me so much. But I then found somebody that the other teachers introduced me to. His name is Bruno Ponterio. He was at, like, a PTA luncheon, and he said, I heard great things about you. You should apply to this school. I'm like, what is this school? And on his card, it said the Bruno M. Ponterio Ridge Street School. It had his name on the school. I'm like, what? So I applied, met the principal, and it just, like, from that moment, everything clicked. Like, I didn't have to suppress the fun side or the magic side. Like, I could lean into it. They appreciated it. And I realized at that moment, I'm not for everyone. This is where I belong. And the things that I couldn't even plan for, like, 6, 7, 8 years later, it's where I met my now wife in that same school district. And every good thing in my life now really, like, stemmed from that decision, which, again, it started as a failure. And so, yeah, you're not for everybody. And you do need to be the same person on the field and off the field. And then just lean into it. If you're doing what you feel like you're meant to be called to do, like, it's going to work out.
Yeah, it's kind of like that concept of, and this has been big in my life recently, it's like, move on and stay ready. And it's like, all right, stay ready for what? It's like, I don't know, but stay ready. Like, be prepared in the sense that you're trying to figure out who you are. You're trying to keep your morals. You're trying to just do the best you can in every aspect of your life. And you don't really know why, other than the fact that if you do that, you have the best chance at being ready for whatever is to come. Is that relatable to that?
1,000%. You know, my buddy David Girard, who's a fantastic mentalist and speaker and friend of mine, he gave me this idea for a presentation I was doing, which is just, it's predicated on the classic phrase, which is that, you know, ready is not a feeling, it's a decision. And when you make that decision to just prepare the best you can and to be ready for what's next, we don't even know what that's going to be. You're there already as a mindset, and it doesn't have to be, we don't always know what our plan is that that's going to work out. But when preparation meets that opportunity, you know, then you are ready for what's next. And then your skills, all the things, they're going to sink, and they're going to be there because you've been doing the work, right? That's where that again, the passion, the pain, all of it comes back in. And it's like, ah, this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I'm ready for. And this is who I'm ready to serve. So yeah, exactly. Be ready and, prepare the best you can, but don't worry about everything being perfect. We can't plan for perfect.
Yeah, and people always, usually people who are lacking or not where they want to be in life will say, man, they got lucky. Man, they got lucky. And it's like, I mean, do I think that there's sometimes a level of luck involved with, you know, success? Yeah, I think especially extreme success. Yeah, there's got to be some luck along the way. But I think a lot of these lucky people that they're talking about are people who were prepared, they were ready, and when the door opened, they were the first in line standing at that door to seize the opportunity.
That's right. That's why being intentional is so important. And seeing everybody as somebody who's important, you know, because you want to serve them, because you want to give, and you never know where those relationships come back into play years later. You know, just like that Bruno Pontario piece, it was just like, because I was a true person who cared about my students, cared about my fellow teachers, cared about the parents, like they saw that. And we're all going to need to borrow from that bank at some point of grace, forgiveness, a favor from somebody else. But, you know, you don't want to be withdrawing when you haven't made the deposit. And so just give. Just keep depositing in everybody's life that you meet. Try to make that impact. The first speaker I really heard that made this feeling that I could do this full time, it happened when I was in college, and then I put it on the shelf and came back to it now. But his name was Rick Rigsby, and he said, your job is to make an impact, not just an impression. And an impression leaves a mark, but then it goes back to its original form. An impact leaves something change, and it doesn't have to be in a huge way. But just every day, set out to make an impact on somebody and lead with intention. And the way to know if you're really leading with intention is like right now, just raise your hand as high as it can go. You know. But what if I give you $1 million if you could raise it just a little bit higher? Right? How many of you went a little bit higher, a little bit further, like we can. And so always just set out to give more, not because you're going to get something in return, but because every interaction matters. And that's what creates the intention, leading to surprise, leading to a permanent relationship. And life is all about those relationships. You never know where they're going to lead.
Yeah, I'd like to know what you think about people who do start out doing what you just said, making an impact, not just an impression, and you know, really connecting with people and leaving them with something positive. That's how they start. But I've seen a lot of people who, and it's probably really easy to do, but people who they're so used to being around people and being on the stage and being and shaking hands and stuff that it's just, it's almost like, we're no longer really connecting. You're just, you know, shaking my hand and telling me something positive. And you don't feel that connection that they're really seeing you. Mm-hmm. You feel like they're kind of seeing everyone.
That's right. I think that you can smell that. That's kind of like the BS meter, right? Like the maybe politician or something that you can feel they're not really tapped into you. They're just kind of wondering, how can I use you to get to what I want? And I think the key to that, you know, genuine care for somebody else is number one, listening. You know, look somebody in the eye when you meet them, repeat their name, because the most magical word in the world is someone's name. So, and I'm really bad with names by nature. I had Lyme disease a number of years ago, and it affected certain things that I still have issues with, one of them being short-term memory, believe it or not, which is ironic because I'm a mentalist. But yeah. I have, because of that, overcompensated with other techniques. And one of those techniques to remember things is to just repeat the person's name. Say it in a sentence. They love hearing it back. I associate in my mind something when I'm talking to Michael that might remind me, this is Michael. What is Michael like? It might be just something that's, you know, what's the word? When a word has the same sound, Michael M.
I don't know what you mean.
Short term, we're looking for alliteration. That's what it is. Alliteration.
I wouldn't even known that.
Yeah. Alliteration is really the initial vowel sound, but consonant, whatever it might be. You know, put two words together that make you remember something. Say that person's name again. Think where you met them some way. But yeah, it's like literally caring about people. And there's a great book called Blue Fishing. And it's really about, like, it doesn't have to be a big thing. You know, I'm really big on saying thank you to people. And instead of waiting for the perfect thank you gift or how to send it or where to get their address, you know, oftentimes it might just be like, I connected with you, Michael. I knew you liked golf. I know you like watches. And there's something that I want to send you, and it has something to, maybe it's a mug, right, with a watch on it or time, whatever it is, your favorite sports team. And I just wrap it in like brown paper, put a Sharpie on it, thinking about you, Michael, not the week after we just had this podcast, but maybe it's a month later, maybe it's 2 months later. It's really out of the blue. And so blue fishing is just knowing that you're thinking of somebody at a random time. And there's so many apps and things that we could do, put into your phone to just say, hey, remember Michael, thank him for what you did on the show. It's his birthday. It's something that he talked about that he likes. I think taking an interest in people is the number one way to show them you care. And that starts with listening.
Yeah, that concept of blue fishing, I just had a conversation with a buddy recently. We were talking about how, you know, especially between guys, young guys, like we're kind of saying like, love you more, and like a little more emotional with each other and stuff like that. And it's more accepted now. And we were talking about how that's true with some people, and him and I are like that together. But then we were talking about how disappointing it is to blue fish and reach out to someone, send someone a text, send someone something or just whatever, and it not be received well, almost received as like, oh, thanks. Nice to talk to you too. We haven't talked to a while. Like, that's very common, and it's disappointing. It really is.
We need to bring it back. You got to normalize that. And again, yeah. I think it's weird if maybe, you know, this person's just out of the blue. Like, do they want something from me? Like, what is it? But when it just becomes you, like, that would just be my thing. I'd be on the way to work when I was driving to work. And like every day I would just not in like a strategic way, but just a habitual way, because it's the discipline that builds good habits, which, you know, creates really the intention. I would just put somebody in my phone. I either leave them a voice memo or call, leave them a voicemail in the morning, because that was my time. Like, I had time free. It was 7. A lot of people still sleeping. When they woke up, they were going to get this voice memo from me. And now I'm kind of famous amongst people for like leaving long voice memos, but it's better than a text. It's, you know, do what you can with what you have, instead of saying, oh, you know what, I'll do it properly later. No, just normalize reaching out, normalize that you don't want anything in return. And one of the things that I think really hits people in a strong way, this is something, it's just kind of, I don't know, it's in my vernacular, it's who I am. I'll tell people like, I'm so proud of you. Like, I have friends who are doing stuff and on social media, and instead of, you know, feeling jealous or saying congratulations, like, I'm just like, dude, I am so proud of you. Like, that is like, look where you were, look where you are, like giving them that glimpse. And they're just like almost taken aback, because it's like, whoa, nobody actually tells me they're proud of me. And I think when we think about everybody is somebody's kid, like, that's important too, because the older I get, I'm like, if you told me I would be 45 years old, I'm thinking of myself as like ancient, you know, I still feel like a kid. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, and I still think about my parents. I just got to bring my dad to an event this past week. And it just makes me appreciate him so much, and how he looks at me as still his son, and how everybody, whether they had, you know, a traumatic childhood or not, it's like, that's even more important to let that person know you see them, you appreciate them, because maybe nobody else is telling them that. Maybe they're overcompensating for something. And I think if you look back at your life, there's a great neuroscience speaker, Rene Rodriguez, and he mentioned at a National Speakers Association event that everyone from the age of 9 to 13 has someone in their life that's either a beacon or a foghorn. And that's either, you know, someone who saved them or somebody who caused a lot of trauma. And we basically spend the rest of our lives either honoring that person or healing from them. And I thought about like how powerful that is, because when you approach anybody, like, that is what they're going through. And you can help them on that journey by letting them know they're seen, letting them know you're proud of them. And it's either going to help them heal, or it's going to help, you know, honor somebody else in their life, and you get to know them even better. But yeah, that's important. So I just always want to be that beacon for someone else, and make sure every interaction we're having is making a positive impact.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And unfortunately, it sucks whenever you look back on your interactions with people, or maybe people you cared about and stuff, and you, to that concept, say, I was not the one that made a good impact. I was the one who caused the trauma. And you know, some people don't have that. I personally, you know, I've changed a lot in the last 6 years, and you know, I definitely did cause some people some of that. And I wonder sometimes, like, do they always think about it, or is that affecting their life still? Or you know, because you can apologize up and down the wall, but at some point, what you did is what you did, or how you made them feel is how you made them feel. And it is very humbling when you look back and you think, man, I was one of the not so great ones for a period of time for this specific person.
Yeah, and thanks for sharing that, Michael. All of us have a time that we could have been better, and I think that forgiving yourself is the first step. Otherwise, you'd be here all day beating ourselves up over that. But just kind of knowing that tomorrow is a new opportunity, and who I am today is not supposed to be the person I was yesterday. You know, like that's the evolution. Like we're learning, and so just like we talk about failures in business and these decisions in our career, like it's going to be the same in our personal lives. And if we were supposed to all get it right from the beginning, you know, it's like, what's this journey for? And it is really to learn, and to learn from those mistakes and those scars, and to, you know, reconcile what we can, but you got to at some point forgive yourself and move on. Otherwise you're going to dwell even more in that past and affect how many people you can be a positive impact on in the future. So absolutely, you got to move forward.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of times too, just to, you know, give everyone listening a little bit of grace, like it's human nature to if you don't feel great about yourself or you're having a struggle, it's human nature to naturally bring people down with you, kind of suck people down. And I think it takes a conscious effort to flip that mindset to where the next time you're going through something, you're able to still reach out for help, but yeah, not act like your problem is something that they should have the solution for.
That's right. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, as we close out, I wanted to talk a little bit about like faith and family and just kind of the impact that that's had on your life. I've had a few people on here that, you know, say, yes, I believe in God. And that's kind of a broad term. And I've had I had a guy who is Muslim on here. And the recent episode I just did last week that's not out yet was all about Jesus. And, you know, I'm a believer in Jesus Christ. And I think that I have not said that enough when asking this to people, not that it has to be my opinion over theirs. It's just to create just kind of a more welcoming environment to that question. I'd like to hear about your faith.
Yeah, I think it's something that people should see in your behavior and in your example, and they should eventually ask, like, what makes that person tick? You know, so many times people are just like, where do you get this energy from? And where do you get whatever? And hopefully it goes beyond energy. And where do you get this, you know, service to others and this love and this forgiveness and all of these attributes that are a part of my faith? And so my Catholic faith has been such a part of my upbringing. And again, like that questioning of why. It's so many times we believe what we believe because our parents gave it to us, or because we were born, you know, whether you're a cradle Catholic or you're just were born with no religion or whatever. And it was like all these points in my life, sometimes you think that that phase is finished, right? I finished my, you know, Catholicism, our sacraments of initiation and confirmation, or your bar mitzvah or something. And it's like, well, I'm done and I'm formed. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. My wife taught me so much about that because, you know, she had a conversion later in life. And, you know, I kind of just accepted these things as truths in my own and then started questioning them, researching them. And I think everybody should do that. You should seek out what it is you're wondering about. And for me, that, again, that greatest sense of fulfillment, it does come through my faith, and it's what allows me to get through the challenges and not just see them as like, why is there suffering? But I'm not trying to have a life that's void of suffering. It's actually, that's kind of the whole point, right? Is that there is purpose in suffering, and that there, everything that we do is for a greater good, and that although I may not achieve everything I want to, as long as I'm in alignment with my values and what I believe is God's will for me, then I kind of can't fail, right? Like, I know I can't fail. And my family has been such a part of that. There is no way I could have taken this risk and left my 9-to-5 job to do this if A, I didn't believe it was for a real greater purpose, and B, if I didn't have the support of my family. And I do it with total trust and faith in God. And so many people want to be in charge of their destiny and their future, and I'm kind of bold enough to say I'm not. I'm not in charge of any of it. So I put it in God's hands, and we do the best we can. And the rest is taken care of. And as long as I'm, you know, in the direction and that I think is where I'm meant to be, the best version of myself, you know, I'm brave enough to pursue it. And I don't think, you know, on the point of some people don't have any faith, you know, whatever someone believes is fine. I'm just not brave enough. As someone else said, like, I'm not brave enough to be an atheist, right? Like, somewhere along the line, I may or may not be right. But yeah, I'm going to err on the side of what I know to be true. And it's not just to keep it to myself. Hopefully, if anybody, you know, is willing to talk and is wondering and wants to know, like, again, where does all this come from? Like, it's not by happenstance, and our whole family is very, very blessed to be who we are. And yeah, that's just a part of who I am.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I think it's the kind of the saying or concept of, look, I might be wrong, but if I'm wrong, we're, you know, I'm on the same level as you. If you're wrong, then you're wrong. That sucks.
So. That's right. Yep. Yeah, no, thank you. But look, Micah, I feel like no matter where we end this, and this might make it to the final cut or not, I feel like people are wondering, like, we should try to do something, because the best form of connection is, like, you know, in person. We're not in person, but I think this could still happen over the internet. Could we try to do something where we kind of connect with your listeners, and maybe just you and me right here? You're in Texas, I'm in Connecticut. Could we try something? Would that be cool?
Yeah. So what do you mean? Like something right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Awesome. Let me ask you, and we didn't set this up. We didn't talk before the show or anything like that. You didn't know I would do this, right?
Correct.
Okay. Do you have a phone on you?
I do.
Could you open it up? I don't know if it's a Apple, you know, iPhone or not. It doesn't matter. Just go to your internet browser, whether that's Safari or you know, Chrome, whatever. It doesn't matter. But I actually embraced this during COVID. My girls and I, you know, we were doing so much online. We were doing virtual events, and the kids are in school. They were like just looking up anything. Now with AI, I always tell them you have to be careful, like, what you're looking up. And so before AI, we would often like reference Wikipedia or just Google something, and so much like misinformation was just being published. Anybody could put it out there. They still can. Do you ever use Wikipedia? Do you use Chat, Claude? What do you usually use?
I use Gemini.
Gemini. Okay. So, but let's not make this an AI thing, because then it's going to think that, like, right, let's just go with what's already there. So I know that, for example, on Wikipedia, there's articles on every, you know, place, famous person, event, activity, whatever that's out there, and people have updated them. But do you have any idea how many of those articles are out there on Wikipedia?
No.
Okay. I don't need a lot, right? And they keep up a ticker, but that probably in the millions. We're going to explore that right now. So they keep track of it on like WikiCount, whatever it is, wikicount.net. Can you go and look this up? Just put in www.wikicount.net and it'll take you to the ticker. Tell me how many articles are there that are published now in English anyway?
Over 7 million.
Okay, over 7 million. And if you go below that to how many words per article, I'm just going to show you like how crazy this is going to be. How many words per article are there?
1600.
Exactly 1600.
1603.
Okay. So if you were to take that and you were to think about how many words per article, right? Times, okay, there's 7 million articles. There's a lot of words out there. Here's what we're going to explore. Ready? I want you to go below that number and click on the link to Wikipedia and just go into Wikipedia right now. And when you're in there, you're going to look up something. Go to a little magnifying glass in Wikipedia. Don't tell me what you're looking up. You can look up anything you want. Person, place, thing, food, activity, doesn't matter. Look up something. Don't show it to the camera. You do it. Just tell me when you're done.
Okay.
hit enter, look up the article. Let's get into it. Good?
Yep.
Scroll through the article. I want you to find a word. Make it a difficult, large word for me, though. And this is where the human connection piece comes out. Because if you think there were like, 1,600 words per article, 7 million articles, like the likelihood of us thinking about a word at the same time, at the same moment is pretty impossible. But just pick a large word. Do you have a big one?
I'm trying to find one.
Now, it doesn't have to be like super loud, but multisyllabic. Just grab a big word. You got one?
Sure.
Okay, just say it over and over in your mind. And at the same time, I want you at this moment to think of the first letter of the word and just look at me, okay? I'm going to try this, see if it works. I'm going to say it at the same time as you. Hopefully, there's not a delay. But if we could both be thinking of the same letter at the same time, that would be the first step to making a miracle and a connection. Are you ready?
Just say the letter?
Yeah, of the word. The first letter of the word. The first letter of the word that you landed on now. C.
S.
Okay. See, I was off. Okay. Let's try it anyway. Okay. So you're on some word, some crazy word. I have no idea. Right. And I want you to, your first letter is S. Now, this is where the human element comes in. I'm just reading you, right? Count to three out loud.
One, two, three.
Okay. And go to the end of the word. And in your mind, think of that letter. And on the count of three, we're going to say that letter together. One, two, three. D. Okay. All right. This could be. I want you to, in your mind, scan the word. And I want you to just land on a letter somewhere in the middle of the word. Keep it in your brain. Just grab a letter, pick it out. Keep one letter in the middle of the word in your brain. You have it?
Mm-hmm.
You went between two. Did you land on a vowel?
No.
Oh, was that an S? You went past an S?
No.
Huh.
I was about to do a vowel.
Okay.
I was in between a vowel.
So I might have gotten that wrong. When you were like, maybe vowel, maybe not. Were you thinking of an E?
Yes.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. On the count of three, I want you just to say your word out loud. One, two, three.
Suggested.
That's insane.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Oh, wait, because there was more than that. Like, that could just be, look, high frequency words. I taught English in sixth grade, right? This could be like, who knows, right? But that could just be a word that comes up in articles. But here's the crazy part. Like, you're thinking of a topic or a place or a person that you had to look up at Wikipedia to be like, this is something that I care about. And this is something that I wanted to research, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want you to think about whatever it is that you put in there. No one else could know this. There's no word that could come up that way unless somebody was in your studio, in your house right now with you, on your phone with you. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I'm just going to write this down here. And this is just based on intuition and feeling. But if you had to just make say in an instant, would you choose Ireland or Greece? Just tell me out loud.
Ireland.
Okay. See, I think this is an activity, not a place. And I also think, because I'm a magician, you're thinking like me, this has something to do with performance on stage with cards. Does this have something to do with cards, like the ace, anything with cards?
What I looked up?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. What did you look up?
Podcast tips and tricks.
Oh, see, it was the tricks part, like the magic. And that's why I got, okay, now it makes sense. Yeah, that is why. Yeah, that's crazy, man. That's what? That is literally podcast tips and tricks. Michael, there is no way. You never spoke about it. I'm not, you didn't.
No, yeah. Crazy.
Dude, this happened right here today. The connection that you will remember and that I will never forget. Michael, you're amazing. Thank you so much for making that happen, man.
Oh my goodness, Tom. Thank you so much. We're wow. We're going to stay on after we're ending this episode, and I've got to pick your brain on it. That is incredible. Thank you for doing that. That just
thank you.
Enlightened my whole day. That's wild.
Absolutely. Wow.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. Thank you for the confetti. Thank you for the audience. Thank you for just being on. Really appreciate you. Tom Pache, everyone.
Michael, thank you so much for having me, buddy. And thank you to your listeners.
Thank you.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.